This is The Point on CAI. I'm Steve Junker, speaking to you from my home in Woods Hole. It's Friday, February 19th, and this is our weekly local news roundup. We'll be discussing the week's top stories with reporters and editors from around the region. Today on the program, we'll be hearing from CAI's Jeanette Barnes and Sam Houghton. Louisa Hufstadter at the Vineyard Gazette will speak with Jessica Hill at the Cape Cod Times and Ed Miller from the Provincetown Independent. We'll hear from Brian Dowd at the Martha's Vineyard Times. CAI's Catherine Ident and Mike Dean will be talking State House news, and we'll talk with CAI's Eve Zuckoff. Now to some of the news around the Cape, the coast, and the islands. We're joined at the beginning here by CAI reporting staff. With us is Jeanette Barnes. Hi, Jeanette.
Good to be here, Steve.
And Morning Edition producer and reporter Sam Houghton. Hi, Sam.
Hey, Steve.
Now, 92 Cape officials, members of the delegation, town officials, signed a letter to Governor Baker this week asking for more state support in bringing vaccine to the Cape region. Jeanette, is this something as wishful as a letter to Santa Claus? Tell us about this letter. What did it say? What kind of case does it lay out?
Well, they said, we write with urgency and alarm about what they say is an inadequate supply of vaccine to Barnstable County and to its towns. They asked the governor for three things: a mass vaccination site at Cape Cod Community College, more vaccine doses for the county clinics that have already been running, and doses of the vaccine that would go to boards of health, which are trying to reach homebound elders with any doses they get. So their main argument really is that the Cape has a higher percentage of elderly people, so it would take more vaccine per capita to get where they need to be. The letter cites some census data about that, showing that people in the 75 and up group and also 65 to 74 are more than double, they say, that of the rest of the state. And State Rep Sarah Peek said the number of vaccines the Cape gets should actually be based on that, on the number of older people and not the overall population.
Now, on the same day that this letter was sent, Governor Baker gave his own assessment of how the Cape is doing. It wasn't in response to the letter, but it wasn't a message that the Cape folks wanted to be hearing.
Right. Well, the governor said that Barnstable County is actually doing well, he says, in terms of the number of people vaccinated. Which Baker says is the second highest rate in the state, number one being Berkshire. But again, the local officials really were just dismayed by that assessment because they pointed out, they pointed to the older population and the driving distance to the mass vaccination sites, which is quite a haul from some places on the Cape. Chris Flanagan, who's the chair of the Dennis Select Board, this week said that nearly 40% of his town's population is 65 and older. So again, the age really is their main argument.
There's a lot of understandable frustration here. But even beyond what Baker and the Cape officials are sparring over, there are bigger questions of equity to consider when it comes to vaccine access. And the fact is, the Cape hasn't really been hit nearly as hard by the pandemic as some other regions or other populations.
Right. Barnstable County is the fourth lowest right now in terms of new cases, but it also has a much lower rate of COVID overall than some areas of the state. And there's a movement right now to make sure that Black and Latinx populations in Massachusetts are getting enough vaccine. There's a coalition that launched this week, made up of 11 different groups around the state. It's called the Vaccine Equity Now Coalition. And member organizations of that are folks like the ACLU, the NAACP, and groups that work with immigrants. And they are calling for more outreach to communities of color and more doses to go to those communities. So I took a look at some of the state data the state puts out periodically. And it appears that the case rate, yes, among Hispanic residents is much higher than it should be for their portion of the population. Looking at Black residents, it's a little fuzzier, but there is a big hole in the data because the latest numbers show that the patient's race is missing for 24% of COVID-19 cases. Mm. So it's now, almost a quarter of cases, they don't have race data. And certainly people are concerned about enough enough vaccine getting to those populations.
Sam Houghton, let's talk about a little good news here. The islands continue to do well in navigating their vaccine rollouts. What can you tell us?
Yeah, Nantucket finished vaccinating residents 75 and older this week. They're actually starting to book appointments for 65 plus today and could open a vaccine clinic on Monday. So far, Nantucket has vaccinated 1,300 people, but that's including healthcare workers. So again, they were able to get the 75 plus vaccinated pretty quickly, but you know, I think that partly that's because the population is small there. And then on the Vineyard, they also appear ahead of the rest of the state. As of Wednesday, they hadn't finished completely all of the 75 plus, but you know, they're getting pretty close to that. The hospital on the Vineyard, they'll start making appointments tomorrow for this next age group, and they'll all also have a clinic on Monday for them. It hasn't been totally smooth sailing on the Vineyard. The hospital is part of Mass General Hospital System, so some patients actually got a call that the state would stop shipping vaccines to hospitals and they were no longer making appointments, but that wasn't true for the Vineyard. They're a little different than the rest of the state. They're getting doses because it's kind of the sole entity providing vaccinations for the community, and it's kind of considered a rural hospital. So a little confusion there, but they are distributing vaccines at the hospital.
Now, on the Cape, Barnstable County commissioners were taking the measure of the county clinics held last week and deciding that they could use some tuning up. Some things worked better than expected, but some things didn't. What were they talking about?
Yeah, so the county, they had a clinic at the Little River parking lot near the National Seashore headquarters in Eastham. That was the first time there, and they delivered almost 400 shots, I believe, and they say that went really well. Appointments were, you know, relatively on time. There wasn't traffic, and they say they could handle a lot more doses there, upwards of 1,000 easily, as they said that. And that came up at a recent Barnstable County Commission meeting this week. And at that same meeting, there was also talk about the Melody Tent Clinic last week, where there was some pretty significant traffic delays. They tried to vaccinate 1,300 people, and that seems like it was a little too ambitious. Sean O'Brien, the county health director, says they're looking for a new location to handle more appointments in that kind of mid-Cape area. And I think one of the problems was that people were getting there really early for their appointments, but they were also showing up trying to get a shot even though they didn't have an appointment. And that kind of threw the traffic pattern off a little bit there. So they're still going to use the site for now. I believe there's actually a clinic scheduled for today for 65 and older age group. But they say they're looking for a better site for these clinics.
But overall, the Cape is in a better place when it comes to COVID case numbers. Is that right?
Yeah, there is some good news. Tuesday this week was one of the lowest numbers of new cases we've seen since October, and that's really for the whole state. But on the Cape, there were just 12 cases on the Cape. Nantucket and Martha's Vineyard also had at least one day this week without any new cases, so that's a good sign. Health officials are saying, though, they are, you know, cautiously optimistic here. I think it's well known that the holidays caused this last surge, and with different households kind of mingling inside. And there's a fear that Easter, which, you know, is until April, that could result in another surge. And that's arriving the same time other variants of the virus will be, you know, more widespread probably. So the wording here is cautiously optimistic. The message is still, you know, wear your mask and stay 6 feet apart.
Jeanette Barnes, State Senator Julian Sear of Truro, is going to be part of a legislative committee at the State House tasked with looking at the vaccine rollout. He's certainly been a big critic in the last few weeks anyway.
Yes. Well, he's the spokesman for the Cape's COVID-19 task force, so that puts him out there definitely as a public voice. And he's been criticizing the state's communication around the rollout and the lack of a mass vaccination site on Cape Cod quite a bit. So with this committee, the governor, of course, is a Republican, and the legislature, which is controlled by Democrats, has formed the committee. It's a joint House and Senate committee, and they're planning to hold hearings starting next Thursday to examine how the Baker administration has distributed the vaccine So Sear is one of five senators on that group.
And problems still continue with the process for people trying to get the vaccine or trying to get appointments to get the vaccine. Problems with the website and the phone line. What can you tell us about that?
Yeah, sadly, yes. So this, as many people have heard, the state's website crashed kind of on and off Thursday, which is when people 65 and older became eligible for the vaccine. The Baker administration apologized and blamed it on the extremely high volume of traffic going to the site. But the critics said the state should have planned for that kind of volume. And then over on the phone side, the 211 phone system continues to have problems, at least on the Cape, where we've heard about it. At least two clinics have had people show up thinking that they had an appointment based on the conversations that they had on the 211 line. And then when they arrived, they were not on the registration list. Maybe one bright spot for our listeners on the South Coast, though, is that they do have a mass vaccination site opening in Dartmouth next Wednesday.
Sam Houghton, the Barnstable County Commissioners are interested in pursuing a program for getting the vaccine to seniors and others who may be homebound or lacking transportation. This is interesting. Tell us about the program.
Yeah, so this started as a kind of a pilot program in Quincy and Chelsea. It's a collaboration between firefighters unions and a healthcare company called Mayskin Medical. They're out of Woburn. They're essentially trying to make the vaccine more accessible for seniors, right, as you were saying, more might be homebound or, you know, at least having trouble with transportation. And the idea is that they partner with local boards of health and senior centers in towns, you know, to bring the doses to seniors or to set up kind of these smaller clinics at a more accessible location rather than these mass vaccination sites. So the county commissioners, again, they took a vote to coordinate in bringing that program to the Cape. But they also sent a letter to Governor Baker asking that the program be made more available to the rest of the state. So as I was saying, the last mile was just a pilot program for those two cities, Chelsea and Quincy, at this point. Both of those communities were hit pretty hard by the pandemic. But I think the county commissioners see this as, you know, another way of getting more vaccine to the region, but also helping out the most vulnerable, seniors that haven't been able to schedule appointments online, as we've been hearing.
Also, Sam, I want to ask you about one non-COVID story here. The towns of Mashpee and Barnstable are facing big wastewater projects, sewering, and they've decided, each of them, to hire some extra help to explain this to residents. What's happening here?
Yeah. So in Mashpee, they're trying to go to Springtown meeting to fund a sewer treatment plant, and they're still waiting on the exact figure of what that will cost. But it's likely $50 million or more, so pretty substantial. But the idea here is that it'll be a pretty tight deadline from when they actually get that final figure and when voters will take it up at town meeting. So they're looking to hire a communication consultant to make sure, you know, they get the word out, voters know what they're actually voting on. But the consultant will likely only be on for 3 months kind of leading up to that town meeting vote. In Barnstable, I get the sense it'll be for a longer period. The town is facing a project that's projected to cost over $1 billion, even closer to $1.5 billion. So they hired a specialist communications about a month ago to coordinate plans, with the public. And actually next week there's a public presentation on the project. So it seems like that, you know, massive plan is starting to move forward. And I think we'll see more on that coming up.
Jeanette Barnes, I want to ask you about one last story that really seems a bit emblematic of how things have been this week as they've been trying to roll out the vaccination effort here. There was a clinic proposed for a site kind of on the Outer Cape, and at the last minute, they kind of had to scratch this. Tell us about this.
Right. Well, the location is the parking area at the Pilgrim Spring Trail, which is kind of on the Truro Provincetown line. And I spoke this week to Charlie Sumner, who's the interim town manager in Provincetown. He says they were planning a walkthrough of this site in preparation for opening it, and that was going to be Thursday, but they canceled it because they just are not going to have enough vaccine as far as they can see from the indications from the state. They were working with Barnstable County on this clinic because they thought that by now more doses would be available, but they just feel now, based on what the governor's saying, that they're not going to be able to do it there. For the time being, I should say.
For the time being. CAI's Jeanette Barnes. Jeanette, thanks for joining us.
You're welcome.
And Sam Houghton, thank you.
Thank you.
You are listening to the News Roundup on The Point. I'm Steve Junker. We're going to the break now. When we come back, we'll speak with Jessica Hill from the Cape Cod Times. Stay with us. This is the News Roundup on The Point. We're talking about the top local stories of the week with reporters and editors from around the region. I'm Steve Junker. A missing woman with Mashpee connections has been found safe. Jessica Hill of the Cape Cod Times is here with an update on this story and more. Hi, Jessica.
Good morning, Steve.
Jessica, Micalee Driver went missing back in November when she was on the West Coast. She's a former Mashpee resident. Now she's back safe with her mother. Tell us what we know about this.
Yeah, so she went missing back in November. She was traveling from Mashpee to Portland and was staying with her mother there. And then she left on November 12th and did not return. She had gotten into a lift and just left. Her mother has been working on trying to find her, putting out missing persons reports and those kinds of things. And then she was found in L.A. She had been trying to get on a bus, but her ID and all of her belongings, she lost them while she was in L.A. So they would not let her onto the bus, and police found her walking along the highway in about late January. She had been trying to hitchhike to go back to Portland. And she returned. Her mother said that they're trying to take it easy with her. She was diagnosed with psychosis about a year ago. So they're just trying to go slow and figure out exactly what happened. But it sounds like that she's been through a lot, and they're just hoping that she gets better and gets the medical help that she needs.
I want to ask you about a story you did this week about a sandwich woman whose run-in with cancer is believed to be caused by her exposure to radon. And it's a cautionary tale. Maybe start by telling us about this woman. Her name is Rosalind Sliwa?
Yes. Yeah, Rosalind was staying in an in-law apartment in the Forestdale area. It was like a basement apartment. And she stayed there for about 2 or 3 years, I think. And she had, you know, perfect health, was very active and athletic. And she developed, she began to develop certain symptoms, losing weight, and her hair was falling out. And she learned that she got lung cancer. And as someone who doesn't smoke, she was really surprised. But then she learned that radon is the country's second leading cause of lung cancer. And she tested her apartment and found that it was way, way above the standard levels allowed by the EPA. So she had to go through chemotherapy, months of chemotherapy, and had to actually have one of her lungs removed. She was talking about how she almost lost her life to this disease. And she learned that it's the level of radon that was in her house is about the same as smoking, like 3 packs a day, was what she was told. So it really developed this whole case of, you know, how prevalent is radon on the Cape? And we learned that it is very prevalent basically all over the country, but more so in the eastern area because of the glacial movement. And a lot of experts say, you know, buy a radon test kit just the same as having a smoke alarm or a carbon monoxide detector.
So radon is something that can be addressed, though, fairly easily within a home.
Right.
And,
yeah.
And your article kind of lays this out, which is helpful information. Go ahead. Tell us. I'm sorry.
Yeah. So basically, the experts say that it's a very simple procedure. They just go down into your basement. Usually it involves like drilling a hole and then putting a pipe down there and leading the gas out of the house and outside. Radon is everywhere, especially outside, but it tends to build up in people's homes, usually going through basements. So once they put the hole in and put the pipe in, there's a fan that they just kind of just like divert the gas out.
It's a kind of a, it's a little bit of a, it's an uneasy thing to think about radon in your home without even recognizing that it's there, because there's no indication it could be there unless you test for it.
Right. It's odorless. You can't see it. And it does take some time usually to develop symptoms, but everybody's different with their genetics. Sometimes it takes longer, sometimes it takes shorter. So for Roslyn, it only took, you know, a couple of years. But the lower you are to the ground, the worse it can be because, you know, radon emits from the ground. So if you're a little bit higher up, then the radon levels will be lower.
Jessica Hill from the Cape Cod Times, thanks for joining us this morning.
Thanks so much.
The pandemic does not appear as though it will put a stop to the MCAS. That's the standardized tests for Massachusetts public schools. For advocates, that's a good thing. Detractors are questioning what meaningful data the tests can capture with schooling already so disrupted. Ed Miller of the Provincetown Independent has this story and joins us now. Hiya, Ed.
Hi, Steve.
Ed, there will be some changes to the MCAS this year. Let's start there. What's going to be different?
Well, yes, the tests, according to the state, will go on this year, unlike last spring when they were canceled after the lockdown and closing of schools. The changes this year that they have announced so far is some differences in the timing, the amount of time that students will have to spend. Maybe the biggest change is that seniors, that is members of the high school class of 2021, will not have to pass the 10th grade MCAS exam in order to graduate. That's been a controversial aspect of the MCAS testing system from the beginning, but this year they have now announced that they're not going to impose that. Another controversial aspect of the MCAS is that the lowest performing schools on the test, or, which are deemed so-called underperforming schools, no school systems will be classified as underperforming this year. And that makes the system subject to going into receivership, where the state actually takes over the school system. So those things have been suspended. But the proponents of the test and the State Department of Elementary and Secondary Education are saying that it's still really important to give the test this year. Even more important, they say, because we need to measure how much has been lost by the disruptions and suffering that schools and children, teachers have been under.
Well, that on the surface, that makes sense. But folks who are questioning the whole purpose of giving the MCAS, and particularly this year, have a different take on it. Tell us what they're thinking here.
Well, yes. For example, the principal of the Nauset Regional High School, Christopher L. Sasser, says, "We don't need the MCAS to know which kids are struggling. We already know," he said. When we see a student who was getting A's and now he's getting C's, that's a much clearer indicator of who needs help. Testing experts basically say the same thing, that especially in a year in which there's been a lot of disruption and people are under higher levels of stress, the validity and reliability of the tests goes way down. For example, the big national testing program, the National Assessment of Educational Progress, known as the NAEP, which is done in a massive, very scientific way with no high stakes, that has no effect on the individual students' outcomes. That organization that runs that has completely canceled testing for this year because they say the data would have no meaning in relation to other years. So we're not going to learn anything from it. So it's silly to give the tests. Those who question the testing also point out that it's very stressful in itself. One of the people that our reporter Paul Sullivan talked to is William Mulholland, who's the president of the junior class at Nauset High School. And he said, first of all, that he always thought MCAS was unfair because it's it's setting every single school against the same standard when every school is not evenly funded. But mm-hmm. he also pointed out that when he was in the fourth grade, he was so stressed out by the MCAS essay test that he started to cry. I think many, many students have experienced that. That's also a question of how much added stress do we need to give kids right now?
And, of course, it means time. I mean, the MCAS really takes up, I don't know, a week of kids' schooling to administer the tests. And of course, teachers end up teaching to the MCAS as opposed to preparing the kids in a sort of what they might say is a more rounded way, a more rounded approach to their education.
Well, you know, that's exactly right, Steve. And MCAS has been controversial, along with other high-stakes tests, ever since it was instituted in 1993, almost 30 years ago now. Mm-hmm. One of the things that I wrote about in my editorial column this week in The Independent is about what the people who actually design and understand testing say about this kind of thing. They're called psychometricians. And
we're gonna have to leave it there, but your column that you're referencing there is really interesting. It has to do with you being sort of on the scene when some of this information was being put together back in 1998. So
that's right. Encourage in Woods Hole.
That's right, and I encourage folks to go to the Provincetown Independent, take a read of that. It's a good one. Ed Miller from the Provincetown Independent. Ed, thanks for joining us this morning.
Thank you, Steve. Great to talk to you.
The Steamship Authority is reporting some relatively good news. Its deficit for the past year should only be about $12.5 million. Louisa Hufstetter of the Vineyard Gazette joins us now to explain why that's a good thing. Hi, Louisa.
Hi, Steve. It's a good thing for Massachusetts taxpayers because earlier this year, the state legislature authorized some relief. Normally, to put this in context, the Steamship Authority, by state law, is not allowed to carry a surplus from year to year. They've got to end their years with no money. If you do have a surplus at the Steamship Authority, they're required to put it into some maintenance buckets for future use. So this is good when the Steamship Authority makes money. It is not good when the Steamship Authority loses money, and the law states, the enabling legislation states that if they do lose money at the end of the year, the port towns have to make it up, Vineyard Haven, Oak Bluffs, Nantucket, Woods Hole, and Hyannis. With the COVID-19 pandemic this year, the losses were looking really stark. Almost a year ago, about $1 million a week. And so the Steamship Authority went to the legislature and said, can you help us? Legislature said, yes, if you have a loss in 2020, the state will make it up rather than the port towns. Meantime, however, the Steamship Authority has pulled itself largely out of that $1 million a week hole to something closer to about $1 million a month for 2020. And because they've received CARES Act funding and also some national funding, some federal funding for transportation, they now don't think they're going to have to ask the state for very much, if at all.
So $12.5 million, it turns out, is getting off easy compared to what they were looking at this time, you know, March, April last year.
It was a bottomless pit at that point. You know, no one could really tell what was going to happen. Steamship Authority took some actions. They actually wound up not running more than 3,000 trips that they had originally planned to run in 2020. They always do move trips around if they have low bookings. Also, in a couple of cases, they had to cancel boats because crew members got COVID and they didn't have enough non-quarantine members to run the ferries. But for the most part, they reschedule them or pull them off the schedule if the demand is low. That's helped save. Also, traffic has picked up. Truck traffic has picked up. Foot passenger traffic is still the lowest.
Louisa, I want to ask you about another item that came up at the ferry board meeting. We have just about a minute here, but I want to touch on this because it's kind of an unusual request. And this was by a company looking to set up a private shuttle service between Falmouth and the island. And they had to go to the ferry board to ask for permission for this.
They said, this is Mr. Jeff Roy, who owns the ferry that runs between Falmouth Inner Harbor and Edgartown's Memorial Wharf. It's the only ferry to Edgartown from off-island. It's called the Pied Piper. And he also owns a marina and an adjoining restaurant in Vineyard Haven. And his request, which he said he would not have needed to make if he didn't already have an existing ferry license, was to run a private small ferry of fewer than 40 people between the marina he owns in Falmouth and the marina he owns, or the marina in Falmouth and the marina he owns on the Vineyard, would only to carry employees of his Vineyard businesses and diners at his restaurant. The Steamship Authority Board of Governors was not terribly impressed with this request. They will take it up again. They want some more time to think about it, but at first blush, they were not liking the idea of giving someone else a way to bring foot passengers to the Vineyard when foot passengers are already down so dramatically at the Steamship Authority.
It's Louisa Hufstetter of the Vineyard Gazette. Louisa, thanks for joining us this morning.
Thanks, Steve.
You are listening to the News Roundup. I'm Steve Junker, broadcasting from my home office. We're going to the break now. When we come back, we'll speak with Brian Dowd at the Martha's Vineyard Times. Stay with us. This is the News Roundup on the Point. I'm Steve Junker. We're talking about the top local stories of the week with our colleagues in the print and digital media. The donut hole is stuck. It's a big issue right now facing Oak Bluffs. Brian Dowd from the Martha's Vineyard Times can ease us through this problem. He joins us now. Hi, Brian.
Good morning, Steve.
Brian, the donut hole is a piece of land owned by the town. It's entirely surrounded by land owned by the land bank. And the two have had an agreement to swap for this parcel, an agreement in place since 2004, but still it hasn't happened. Your report on this, it's like a Dostoevsky novel with so many characters and twists. Start by telling us about the donut hole itself, where it is, and what appears to be holding up this land transfer.
Sure. So the donut hole is a 24-acre parcel of land that is located in the Southern Woodlands area of Oak Bluffs, which is a prominent area in the town because it's got... it's next to one of the main roads on the island, Edgartown Vineyard Haven Road. It's next to high school, community services. And the donut hole, it's a landlocked piece of land. It's completely surrounded by a large swath of land that the land bank owns and is in conservation. So in 2004, the town of Oak Bluffs and the land bank came to an agreement, and essentially the town... like, here, you guys can take the donut hole, so you have a more continuous piece of land in conservation, and the land bank would then carve out a 24-acre piece of land for the town, and that would connect to an existing piece of land that the town already owns on that has frontage on Edgartown Vineyard Haven Road.
So that's kind of the setup here, and they even agreed to this proposal, both parties, back in 2004. But since then, this deal still hasn't gotten done, and the town really wants to make this happen.
Yeah, so, right, the issue is that this deal was made 17 years ago and still hasn't happened, and the town really wants this to happen because for several years now, they've been... town has been planning affordable housing development on that small 8-acre parcel that they own. If this deal goes through, the town could instead of planning affordable housing for 8 acres, the town could plan for 30 plus acres. Mm. And what's holding this deal up? For a while, it was some title issues. You know, part of that 2004 deal was that the town had to solve some title issues with that donut hole parcel, which dates many, many, many years. And in 2018, they ironed those issues out. the selectmen voted to get this deal done. But now the land bank is saying, you know, we'll get on the whole land swap done once the town corrects the assessor's records for two separate parcels that are near the Southern Woodlands but are not part of the donut hole. The land bank would really like to get all of these pieces of land corrected, specifically the two parcels which the land bank purchased 4 years before the donut hole deal back in 2000. But the assessor's records were never corrected. Those two parcels still say that the town owns them when it is, in fact, the land bank that owns them.
Brian, I want to ask you real briefly about another story, too, that you've got in the paper, which is about folks 65 and older can start signing up now to get a coronavirus vaccine on the island and what this must feel like for folks there. And this all starts tomorrow.
Yeah, so Governor Baker, you know, announced this week that he was expanding the eligibility for vaccines to the 65 and older and people with two chronic health conditions. The Vineyard Hospital is going to be opening appointments for those beginning Saturdays when people can start booking appointments. So if people are in you know, either 65 years and older or have two chronic health conditions, they should visit the Martha's Vineyard Hospital website. There's a really easy bullet point list on how to sign up, and you can sign up right on the website. I will say it's a kind of a rolling application process, so the hospital officials likened it to the steam authority booking a booking a ferry for your car. So go back, you know, keep checking the website. But they're hoping to get everyone pretty soon.
Brian Dabb from the Martha's Vineyard Times. Brian, thanks for joining us.
Thanks, Steve.
The state's COVID-19 vaccine appointment website got a workout this week after news broke that Governor Baker had opened vaccine eligibility to people age 65 and up and to people with two or more approved health conditions. The website got 250,000 hits on Wednesday, the day of Baker's announcement, and then it crashed yesterday when appointments opened for this latest age group. CAI's Catherine Iden talked with our State House reporter Mike Dean about this and about why the state's unemployment system is going bankrupt. Here's their conversation.
Good morning, Mike.
Hey, good morning, Catherine.
Some big news this week. People age 65 and up and people with two or more specific health conditions are now making appointments, or at least are eligible to make appointments for the COVID-19 vaccine. But there have been some hiccups.
Yeah, absolutely. When you add 1 million new people to the eligibility rolls, like Governor Baker did by moving his vaccination plan forward like this, it's going to stress the system. When he made that announcement earlier this week, he said, you know, three or four times he repeated himself saying that it's going to be very difficult for people in that age bracket to get an appointment because so many people and demand is going to be so high and because supplies are so low. We're still getting essentially the same amount of vaccine from the federal government that we've been getting, you know, the last few weeks. There were reports of an uptick of about 25%. Mary Lou Sutters, the Health and Human Services Secretary, mentioned that on Wednesday, but that's not really set in stone, and it's not really enough to make too much of a difference, especially when we're adding 1 million new people into the system. So at 8 a.m., when the new appointments for those 65 and up went online on Thursday morning, the website crashed. And so we're already seeing the stresses of the system. And, well, it's proving Baker prophetic because he did say it will take almost a month for people to make an appointment to get in there and actually get their shot in this new phase.
What is the reasoning behind opening the door, as you said, and allowing as many as 1 million additional people to essentially get in line along with those who are 75 and up who haven't gotten their vaccine yet, if we're waiting for more vaccine from the federal government and we're not getting nearly enough?
If we go back to phase one of Baker's plan, it was very targeted. It was looking at the most vulnerable people, the sickest, the oldest people in nursing homes, first responders, the medical community, people really on the front lines. Baker said this week that he heard from the people of Massachusetts over and over again, vaccinate, vaccinate, vaccinate. They wanted shots in arms, and there was less interest in who exactly was getting them. They wanted a broader approach. So that's where Baker turned his attention to, so that they can most effectively and quickly use all of the supplies that are coming from the federal government when they get here. So that door opening, that broad swath of eligible people, is to take up the limited supply that we already have, instead of going further down the road of the most vulnerable, of those 75 and older, tracking them down, trying to convince people who might not want to get the vaccine, you know, people who don't have easy access to the mass vaccination sites. So Baker said that they got 50% of the 75 and over population already immunized with this vaccine, and that means it's time to move on to the 65 and up. It is still limited by the federal supplies, though, so we're really not going to see a change in the frustration level that people are going through, even if they are now eligible.
How do people feel now that the governor did allow a larger swath of people to hop in to the fray and clamor for an appointment?
Initially, there was a lot of hope. It's seen as something of a light at the end of the tunnel that, you know, we are moving forward in the vaccination plan. We are making progress and we are opening it up to younger and younger people. That is a positive. As we saw on Thursday morning that the website just crashed, we're also in a way doubling down on the frustration people are going to have to go through in order to access these, again, very limited supplies. So it's a mixed bag of reaction. You could say that obviously the website isn't functioning the way it should. That's a failure. But given that there are so few supplies, that the governor moving forward to the 65 and over population could still be seen as a positive step.
In other news, Mike, you had a story this week about the unemployment system in Massachusetts, a system that has been very important in this ongoing pandemic. But the crisis caused by the pandemic and other issues may actually bankrupt the system.
Yeah, it's actually been a problem since before the pandemic that the wages and benefits that the unemployment system gives out had been rising with incomes and with wages. So it was always staying modern with the benefits that people in the system got. However, the taxes that were being charged to businesses in order to replenish that trust fund was not increasing at the same rate, meaning it's been out of whack for a while and could become insolvent. Then the pandemic hit, and of course, the trust fund got drained because the unemployment went through the absolute roof. That then triggered a increase in those taxes to replenish the coffers that the unemployment trust fund uses. But again, during the pandemic, you don't want to raise taxes on businesses, especially small businesses that are going to be struggling to make ends meet because of the new economy that we're dealing with right now. So what does the legislature do? They're, and the governor as well has a bill to this effect. Borrow your way temporarily. The short-term fix is to take on debt to maintain the system so it doesn't go bankrupt, and then figure out a new way to raise those taxes or find some other means of reinflating that trust fund.
And that is CAI State House reporter Mike Dean talking with us from Beacon Hill. Mike, thanks. Have a great weekend.
Oh, you too.
And that was CAI's Catherine Iden speaking with Mike Dean. You're listening to the News Roundup on The Point. I'm Steve Junker. The Boston-based Conservation Law Foundation has filed a lawsuit against the town of Barnstable because the town's sewage treatment plant located in Hyannis, it says, is polluting nearby coastal waters. CAI's environment reporter Eve Zuckoff joins us now to talk about it. Hi, Eve.
Hi there, Steve.
Eve, what does the Conservation Law Foundation say is happening here exactly?
Yeah, so the Conservation Law Foundation, CLF, is suing under the Clean Water Act. They say that the treatment facility is really acting like a giant septic system, which is a problem because we build sewers usually so that they can help, you know, reduce the nitrogen load. That is not what this sewer and this treatment facility is doing. It's releasing nitrogen through the groundwater into Lewis Bay because it's not designed to remove nitrogen, CLF says. And in fact, the facility is the single largest source of nitrogen in the Lewis Bay watershed. And these coastal waters are already really degraded by that excess nitrogen and nutrients. It fuels algae blooms, it kills plant and marine life. And CLF says they want to stop that from happening.
Now, the town has a forceful response to this. Tell us, what does the town say is happening and what options it looks like the town has now?
Yeah, the town really rejects the claims. An email of Barnstable town officials said, contrary to CLF's allegations, the town adheres to applicable environmental requirements and is taking decisive action and effective action to improve water quality. They also said, you know, by wading into a lawsuit like this, our people lose time and resources that we now have to spend on this instead of improving our systems. But if this suit does go to trial, the town could be forced to change the way things work. If the foundation wins the lawsuit, the town would be forced to operate its wastewater treatment plant under a more rigorous federal permit, and they'd have to upgrade the facility so that it is operating at the highest level in terms of reducing nitrogen pollution, and it would not be cheap. It would be very, very expensive for the town.
I want to ask you about another story you covered this week. This week marked the end of a years-long effort by a group of climate activists to amend the region's overarching policy plan so that it includes goals to reduce greenhouse gas emissions. Tell us a little bit about this, because this really was a hard-fought victory for these folks.
That's right. So a couple of years ago, activists with 350 Cape Cod and the Sierra Club, these environmentalists, took a look at the 2018 regional policy plan, the plan that guides all of our kind of policies across Cape Cod. And they said, there's nothing in here that specifically says, how are we going to reduce greenhouse gas emissions produced on the Cape? And they've spent the last few years kind of working their way. A couple months ago, going to the commission, and the commission ultimately amended the plan to include greenhouse gas emission reduction goals. And then this week, we finally made it to the Assembly of Delegates, this amended plan, and the Assembly of Delegates unanimously voted to amend the regional policy plan so that it included these greenhouse gas reduction goals. And the significance of this is that now the Cape, written into its policy plan, has a way to look at upcoming development projects. So, you know, solar projects that involve the clear cutting of trees. And they can say, does that align with our codified goals to reduce greenhouse gas emissions? And it's a new framework. It really is a significant win for environmentalists.
Eve, in the last minute here, I want to ask you about some public hearings that have been going on. These are about fishing regulations, changing fishing regulations to protect North Atlantic right whales. You attended a hearing this week. What did you hear?
Yeah, so there was feedback from a lot of conservationists, a lot of fishermen. Fishermen, for the most part, the things they would have to change is they would be affected by state-specific gear marking colors, new colors. There'd be new fishing closures, one south of Nantucket, and they would have to add more traps per trawl. That was something that they did not like. They called burdensome and dangerous, a few of them. But even angrier than fishermen were conservationists. They felt like the protections just don't do enough to a population of right whales that is on the brink. The protections would only create a 64% reduction in risk. The feds could have, you know, come up with protections that created an 80% reduction in risk. Didn't get there. So we'll be watching that story.
That is CAI's environmental reporter, Eve Zuckoff. Eve, thanks.
Thank you, Steve.
That's our show for today. I want to thank my guests. We heard from CAI's Jeanette Barnes and Sam Houghton. We spoke with Louisa Hufstetter at the Vineyard Gazette, Jessica Hill at the Cape Cod Times. We heard from Ed Miller at the Provincetown Independent and Brian Dowd from the Martha's Vineyard Times. We heard from CAI's Catherine Ident and Mike Dean talking State House news. And, of course, Eve Zuckoff there. Thanks to our Dan Treidel back at the studio. And a very special thank you today to my mom. On this day, a good many years ago, she gave birth to me. Thanks, Mom. I love you. From my home in Woods Hole, I'm Steve Junker. Thank you for listening.